Welcome back, I'm Erin. This episode is a continuation of our interview with prosecutor and assistant attorney general from Missouri, Catherine Dolan. In the second half, we get Catherine's perspective on several of the topics that were highlighted in the Oxygen show. So I just want to thank Catherine again for taking the time to talk to us and answer our questions. And here is the second half of the interview. As long as we are talking about Cecil Smith's answers to questions, this was probably my biggest critique of the show, and it has to do with the timeline.
Really? You're not going to say it's the psychic? Because that would be mine.
it's up there. So he says that he was driving the SUV that was seen by this witness A, who drove by the scene after she left work that evening. And in the show's own timeline, they have witness A passing the scene at 7:37 p.m. and Cecil Smith showing up at the scene at 7:46 p.m. So, again, I don't want to be an ass about it, but according to their own timeline, witness A showed up 9 minutes before police were even on scene. And that is a major problem for me because, well, you might say that, like, you give 5 minutes here or there on any timeline, except we have witness A's cell phone records and the location that she made the call because it was the first time that they could get cell reception in that area. So she might have been further east when she made the call, but that would only push the timeline even earlier. So we have a pretty precise, within 2 or 3 minutes, time of when she would have passed the weathered barn corner where the crash was. And that time, I think in the show they say 7:37. My timeline was more 7:33 to 7:37, depending on how fast she was driving. Smith doesn't arrive until 10 minutes later. How do you square that? I mean, I'm not necessarily asking you, Catherine, but from the information that they have provided, there's no logical way that it's possible.
So my caution with timelines is dispatch logs. So as much as prosecutors have to and do rely on times and dates and everything listed in dispatch logs, and we'd like to pretend that every time an officer gets to the scene, he radios in, and every time he clears, he radios in, and every time he picks his nose, he radios in. it's just not reality. And this is nothing wrong with police officers, the way they do things, but sometimes you get caught up in things and it's difficult to remember. Sometimes you think of things and add them back in later. Sometimes your clock on your car is off, or it doesn't match, you know, dispatch, and it doesn't match the cell phone clock of a witness. You know, they want to get up early for work and they set their, cell phone clock 15 minutes earlier. And so your dispatch log doesn't match. I mean, I would caution you in taking times on logs or times on police reports as gospel, because it's when you're getting down to a matter of minutes. I mean, I would just caution you about kind of putting entirely too much stock in trying to create a timeline from dispatch logs. I know it's all you have. I know that's tough to say, but sometimes there's a more innocent explanation, and it's just times were off, or someone didn't radio in, or someone didn't mark down where they were because they got caught up in other things.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, we've had this conversation like 1,000 times. Like, so we're both aware that the dispatch log may not be 100% accurate. Okay. Cell phone records, though, I don't think – so the cell phone, we're using the time of her call, which I think that is the time because you're going from cell tower records, mm-hmm. which are not going to go on the time that's on the phone. They're going to go on the time that the cell tower has. And I would hope, I can't prove that the dispatchers are using time that's synchronized to a source on the internet that has the actual time. I don't know that for sure, but I would think that that would align with the cell phone time. So as for what Cecil Smith said, you know, when he called in, when he said he got there. Yeah. You have to look at other stuff to corroborate that time or put it within bars.
Right. And I believe he did say that he didn't radio back right away. He got out to look around the car to see if anyone was injured.
Right.
Right. However, in the accident report that he filed, he reports arriving 1 minute earlier than what is in the dispatch logs. So that's the time that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, because both say the same thing.
Okay, I understand.
Well, they say roughly the same thing. They're off in the way that you'd expect them to be off if they're roughly accurate.
But 10 minutes is a lot of time.
Yeah.
Oh, you had mentioned the chain of custody earlier. And one of the questions, again, that Tim and Lance in the Missing Mara Murray podcast asked the state police was about the chain of custody. I don't think that they worded it this way, but where the Saturn had been towed that night.
Okay.
And the police responded by saying that it had been towed to the troop and then released to the family and then repossessed, essentially. But we know, I'm going to say for a fact, that it was actually towed to a mechanic named Mike Lavoie and put in his personal garage and left there for several days. And the reason I say we know this for a fact is because not only has Fred Murray stated it, but also a mechanic was interviewed by the Oxygen show and corroborated that statement or that fact that it went to his personal garage. And he explained that, well, he didn't have a big operation at that point, so he didn't really have anywhere else to put it, which is understandable. But my point is that a problem with the chain of custody? Or could it be a problem? They sort of glossed over the fact, or they didn't gloss over it. They didn't even mention that it was towed somewhere else. They made it seem like the police had it in their custody the entire time, and that doesn't appear to be accurate. And I'm not saying that they're lying. They might have a good reason for not mentioning that, but it seems like a chain of custody issue to me.
Yeah. So I live in kind of a rural state. I would not put it completely out of the realm of possibility that police would utilize a private tow company and a private tow company lot. And if that lot is at that driver's home, I wouldn't completely discount as something totally crazy or something totally unheard of. I would put it that way. As far as chain of custody goes, I think it depends. Chain of custody only really matters if you get to a point where it matters. And whether that be trial and you've got the defense attorney arguing about it, if you've got, you know, the police evaluating the worth of any amount of evidence and whether to go forward with the investigation based on it. So, you know, it's their evidence. And they can kind of do with that what they will up and until a point where you charge someone and then you're going to court and there's something in that vehicle or the vehicle is changed or there's some sort of problem with it. And it usually has to do with testing, honestly, chain of custody. You know, was there something tested that you could argue that the results of that were tainted by it being out of police custody for a while? But you know, was it secured? Was it a secured lot? Was it in his garage? How was it locked? Who had keys to the garage? You know, so if it went directly from the accident site onto the car or into the tow truck into this guy's garage and he's locked it and he's the only one with the key and there's no evidence that it was tampered with and then it was released from the garage to, you know, back to the troop or whatever. Probably not necessarily a problem.
Okay. I think you mentioned it earlier, but one of the things that they do pretty early on is they want to interview people because people's memories change.
Right.
Or they erode essentially over time.
Sure.
And one of the things I found interesting is that they didn't interview her sister, Julie. They never spoke to her. And she was probably the person in the world who was the closest to her. She was just a few years older and they spoke a lot on the phone. I think Julie lived in North Carolina at the time because she was in the Army. But still, she would have had probably, of anyone, the best sort of insight into what Maura's state of mind was and why she might have been going to New Hampshire to begin with. And they never spoke to her. Is that strange?
If that's true, and since we don't have the police end of things, we're trusting her word, which I have no reason to find incredible, but I just want to keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. So if that is true, I would say that that's unusual. I would think that probably not that night, because again, we have to keep in mind the scope of what we're looking at. So we were looking at a minor one car collision with no injury, with alcohol in the car, and a young driver, single occupant. So from that perspective, you know, it's not surprising that not a lot was done that night or in the days thereafter, but certainly after it became apparent that this was something more, I would have expected the whole immediate family to have been interviewed, certainly. You know, not to make excuses, but if you're looking at a family member who's not in the immediate area, I mean, physically, who lives in a different state, that could be part of it. Certainly, they may not have considered that that person would have been kind of had knowledge about the case. But yeah, I would say that it's pretty surprising for a sister to not be spoken to.
As a prosecutor who might look into a case like this, would that be something that you would want to have on record to look at? There's an interview with a family member in that case.
Yeah, certainly. And not just by virtue of the fact that it's a family member. Plenty of people don't have close relationships with their family or estranged or whatever. But anyone who would have contacted my subject recently in relation to their disappearance or to their victimization. So, yeah, I mean, it sounds like they had a lot of phone communication, that they talked fairly frequently, talked within probably a few days of her disappearance. So, yes, I would want to talk to that person, yes.
So, similarly, of the 254 contacts and 106 witness statements, another person that they didn't speak to was Linda Salamon, who was the last person on Maura's phone record. I think that there was like a 2-minute or 3-minute call, and Salamon had owned a condo that she had stayed at in the past, so the presumption is that she was looking to make a reservation. Mm-hmm. But the police never reached out to her either.
According to Linda, yes.
According to Linda, right. Yeah.
I think, is it, Aaron, I can't remember if this is something I actually read or if this is something we speculated about. Did they reach out to the hotel and spoke to someone else who didn't directly talk to Maura, or they didn't at all? Okay.
They didn't at all, as far as we know. I mean, it's possible that they tried to make contact and weren't able to. But she's from the area. She's in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if Linda's basically saying, like, well, they never spoke to me.
No, she said she never got a call at all.
Okay.
You know, I mean, if they're wondering where Maura was going, I would think that it would be possible that she could have had a conversation with somebody and not gotten a reservation. But Linda could have given her suggestions about where to go or just anything, any kind of insight that she could have perhaps provided, but they didn't even reach out to her. So that, I don't know how strange that is or unusual. Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to go through the bother of getting your subject's cell phone records, then you're going to follow up with everyone who is on those records in a reasonable relation to the incident that you're looking at. So yes. And again, with the caveat that you're talking to people who are making representations about what or wasn't done. And Ethan makes a good point, is that what if there was an attempt to have contact made and there was just a misconnection there, or, you know, what if a proxy was spoken to, an employee, something like that, and they didn't get the message that the police were looking for them. I don't know. Of course, I'm reaching for straws, but there are a couple caveats there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we can't assume for sure. It's just in light of the fact that they also didn't talk to Julie. Well, that's a pattern right now.
But they did talk to some people. I mean, this is what's so weird. I mean, they talked to 106 witnesses. So it's like
106 witnesses.
It's not like they weren't doing anything. Like, it's just weird.
It almost seems like they had an opinion about where the case was going and some reason to believe that it wasn't necessary for them to speak to either Julie or Linda because it wasn't going to help them in their investigation. Like, that's the only reason, besides incompetence, that I can think of, that they wouldn't have spoken to those two people.
Does that make any sense, Catherine? I mean, is that something that might happen? I mean, to me, that's kind of extraordinary. Even if the police had a theory, you know, like, we know what happened. It was this guy, and we're going to only focus our investigation there. Like, wouldn't, just as a matter of routine, you're still going to talk to the family. You're still going to call everyone on that cell phone record, right? I mean, am I crazy to say that?
No, I agree with you. I've said I agree. I think that you're going to want to try to talk to everyone that had spoken to your subject in close in time to whatever incident you're looking at. So whatever family members talked to her last, whatever calls that she's made, I would expect that to be done. And it's kind of like a stair step of, I don't want to say inattention because that kind of weakens it, but the amount of investigation and the type of investigation. So if you start with a one car collision where you have indicia of intoxication and the driver is missing, to the driver is really missing, to the driver is missing and foul play might be involved. So you have to kind of think about it on a spectrum for the type of investigation that's going to be going on, the type of seizures, the type of interviews, the type of, evidence and investigation. So just kind of keep that in mind, again, going back to the scope of what we're looking at and when.
So to that point, and I don't want to belabor this like too much more because we already talked about it, but to me that does suggest that what Butch Atwood said or didn't say is very relevant, because if it wasn't a case where there was a reason to believe that the person was intoxicated, perhaps it would have been treated differently.
Right. Probably, yeah.
So that's where I have a problem with them continuing to say that it was a clear, you know, drunk driving incident when that wasn't necessarily the case.
Well, there was alcohol in the car.
There was alcohol in the car, but that's not a crime.
Yes, no, I agree with you. But you have to look at it, the totality of the circumstances. You have a car for no real apparent reason that slid into a tree, and then you find alcohol in the car.
It was a hairpin turn. I mean, I grant that, yes, it was an accident. But it was 7 o'clock at night, 7:20 at night.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the police are probably likely going to think it's a strong possibility that the driver was drunk in a single car accident. I assume they make that assumption on any single car accident. You know, the question is, how many times does Butch Atwood have to say, I don't think she was drunk, before you start to wonder, well, maybe she wasn't. You know, what do you have to do to get to that point with an investigation?
On top of that, the bolo that was put out that night at 7:54 p.m. didn't say anything about the female who was presumably on foot possibly being intoxicated. If he truly believed that she was slurring and leaning and couldn't stand up straight and was wandering around on foot in the dead of winter and completely dark roads with no streetlights, I feel very strongly as though he would have communicated that to oncoming traffic. I mean, I could be completely wrong, but if he truly believed that she was drunk, I don't see how that he leaves that out of the bolo, and not just the bolo, but any narrative statement in the dispatch logs at all. Like, there's no mention of alcohol.
Yeah, you're saying that the initial bolo that went out by the police did not mention intoxication, and you're saying that's troubling because now the police are relying on evidence of intoxication for why it wasn't investigated as deeply?
Yes.
It seems to be the case. They said in news articles after the fact that she was probably intoxicated, or that they thought she wasn't intoxicated, but nothing that night, because we've seen the dispatch logs and the police report.
Yes.
And the bolo.
Right.
None of those mention alcohol, other than the wine in the car. They do, the police report does mention the wine in the car, but the bolo doesn't
say it's open.
Yeah, it doesn't say it's open.
They definitely give a very strong impression that she fled the scene of her own volition. And that's where I think it's really important, because if she wasn't drunk, she would have no reason to flee. And there's other elements about what they've said that point to this. Like, Butch Atwood has also said that he asked if she wanted him to call the police. She said no. She had called AAA. which probably wasn't true because she couldn't have had cell reception in that area. And from that, the press release that was released on February 12th by the Haverhill Police says the witness saw a lone female with no apparent injury who appeared impaired due to alcohol consumption. When asked if she needed help or the police to respond, she replied no. And after that, it just began to grow into this thing where she pleaded and begged him not to call police. So then you have them saying, well, she was drunk and she was pleading with him not to call. She was fleeing the scene. That's what happened. Mm. And it's not like these are just offhand comments. Lieutenant Screnza, who was in charge of her case, the state police, stated that she pleaded with him not to call the police in a press release in the months following. And that's, I don't think that that's true. That's not what Atwood's saying, at least.
So do you have statements from Atwood that are directly contradictory? Like Atwood is saying, she did not plead with me not to call the police.
No.
Or is it just that he never mentioned whether that happened or not?
In that case, I haven't found anything that he directly contradicts the police. He says things like, I asked if she needed me to call the police. She said no. So it's not as strong of a case as the alcohol and him contradicting that particular point. But even in their own press release in the days following, they don't give that strong of a statement about it. They just said she replied no.
Right. And they may have more information in that they've kept internal that they've gotten since those press releases. I mean, those press releases may have been accurate to their knowledge at that time, and they just have more information that they've developed since then that would support their statements to that effect now.
So you're saying there could have been a subsequent interview with Butch Atwood where he did say that she pleaded not to call the police, and that's what they were reporting in a later press release.
Sure.
I mean, that's definitely possible. I find it a little bit hard to believe because if somebody that you don't know is begging you not to call the police, it's pretty incriminating. Like, that, do you want to appear guilty? Like, who would do that? If I didn't want the police to be called, I wouldn't say, please, please, please don't call the police.
Yeah.
I'd say, no, don't worry about it. I'm fine. Like, it's just kind of hard to believe on its face to me. And saying that you don't need the police because you've called AAA is not the same as do not call the police.
Right.
It's just not. And they're trying to equate the two or conflate the two. Pretend that they have the same meaning. I just... points to the lack of sincerity.
Here's a question. Why wouldn't Butch Atwood have said, if she was really pleading with him not to call the police, wouldn't he have mentioned that from the beginning? Why would that have only come out later? Unless he was, like, led to it? I mean, does that seem possible that, the police were, like, on a follow-up conversation with him, maybe were like, well, did she, I mean, how insistent were you, or how insistent was she that you not call the police? Is it possible that they were kind of looking for that answer and led Butch Atwood to make a statement that they could say in a press release she pleaded with him not to call the police?
Is it possible that they asked him how forcefully, how insistent was she that you don't call AAA? How insistent was she that you don't get the police involved? And he says something like, pretty insistent. I mean, she was pretty firm that she had it under control and that she'd be fine. So when they draft up their press release or their report, it's, that she, I don't know that I would use the word pleaded, it's a little strong, but, and she was insistent that the police not be called. Because again, you're filtering words through multiple sources. This is why we don't use hearsay in court. It's like the telephone game.
I know.
Because you're filtering words through multiple people, and my version of pleaded might be different from a witness's version of pleaded. I mean, yeah. So that this is the problem when you're playing the telephone game with police reports, and it's a problem for law enforcement, it's a problem for prosecutors and dealing with it, and it's a problem for witnesses. So
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So
well, it's awfully convenient for the police if they're interested in it looking like she was drunk and trying to avoid being seen by the police. If they want to look better, it's like, well, it just so happens to do that. Mm. that the statement has changed now to she was pleading You know, isn't it convenient that it looks better for the police as time goes by and as they can't find her? I mean, that doesn't mean anything. That's not proof of anything. But I'm just like, come on.
I wouldn't, and I don't want to kind of sound like I'm jumping to the defense of law enforcement at every turn, but I wouldn't attribute it to malfeasance or be quick to attribute it to kind of deliberate obfuscation of facts or, again, some sort of conspiracy theory. Sometimes cops want to do the right thing. They honestly do want to do the right thing, but they may not have the kind of same interpretation of facts maybe that other people do. And again, hindsight is 20/20, and what they write down that a witness said may not be completely accurate, and due to no kind of an intentional misleading by the police officer, it's just a difference in language. But I understand that it looks a little different now that we go back. And yes, does it look convenient for the police? Maybe. But I always try to give the benefit of the doubt, which I'm sure you understand.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I came into this giving them every benefit of every doubt. And at some point, there's an overwhelming amount, it appears, of discrepancies. The simplest answer is that they're trying to cover themselves, and it might not have anything to do with their disappearance. I don't think it does. Maybe it's as obvious as they're just making excuses for not doing as great of a job as they should have early on. And it's that simple.
But that's human nature too. I mean, so everyone tries to make themselves look better. But you know, I agree. I think that it's probably a situation where, and I think that they spoke to this in the oxygen special, the police that they talked to. You know, could we have done a better job? Could we have tracked down more leads? Could we have gotten started sooner? Could we have, you know, walked in the opposite direction or searched this section of woods or whatever it is? Because again, hindsight's 20/20. So I think they'll acknowledge there were shortcomings in their investigation, both objectively and subjectively. So I think that they believe that there were problems. I think that people looking at this case could say that there were problems. You know, and so there may be a degree of that trying to kind of color the facts to make that seem a little bit better, and that may be true.
There's one more thing that I think adds some credibility to that possibility, or that the police might have had incentive to act almost defensively, and that is the fact that they're looking at us like we're under attack by this guy who, yes, he's distraught, but he's claiming that we're doing a bad job, and so they're almost, you know, they almost have additional incentive because of that to portray themselves in the most positive light possible, almost as a counter to what they see as unjust or unfair characterization.
Yes, and all of that is defensible. What's not defensible is making up facts about the case, and that's where I draw the line. And so you can interpret things however you want to interpret them, but you cannot make up facts that she was drunk, because it actually does change the nature of the case. It really does. It gives her motive to want to flee.
Right.
It's important, but I guess if you're the police, you might say, well, but we're the ones investigating it. So, like, they don't see any particular reason to set the record straight, because to them, the legitimate investigation is the one that they're doing. It's not the one that, you know, Tim and Lance are doing, or James Renner is doing, or Aaron and Ethan are doing. So to them, like, us having the right impression might be insignificant. I mean, would you agree with that, Catherine?
Well, I agree with you that no one should make up facts. I don't care who you are. But I think you also need to be careful about a distinction between making up facts or kind of telling deliberate falsehoods and talking about inferences that are reasonably supported by the evidence, but with which you may not agree. And so given the fact that we don't have all the information, we don't have all of the records, and I understand that that is of their own doing, right? So I do understand that we're at a disadvantage because of the lack of the release of it. But, you know, police officers, just like anyone else, do rely on inferences in doing their investigation. They have to. It's their job to make deductions from the facts that they do have. And so something like she's being drunk is not wholly unsupported by the evidence. I understand that there is some discrepancies with the different facts, but, you know.
I do agree. I completely agree. I don't think it's completely unreasonable for them to have come to that conclusion. I just, when they're so unwilling to share anything except for that information.
Right. Yeah, no, I know. I get it.
Yeah, all these men investigating this case might just be saying, Oh, there was alcohol in the car. She was probably drunk. Oh, I saw some stains. It was probably drunk. She was probably drunk.
Not only that, but in his... I'm sorry, Ethan.
Sure.
But yes, this gets under my skin quite a bit. Because in his press release, in Lieutenant Kearns's press release about the case several months following sort of their... where they were at that point, there's almost no information other than his perception of her state of mind, which was frantic and emotional. He goes on at, like, he lists that she was upset at work several days earlier. He lists the fact that she had gotten into a car accident with her father's car and was probably upset about that. He directly says that there were things going on in her personal life. Mm-hmm. That's completely irrelevant for the most part. Like, it has nothing to do with the case, because you don't know where she is. You don't know what happened to her, and you're assuming that it's foul play at that point. So what difference does it make it what her emotional state was? The only reason that you say that is to paint a picture and give an impression and, frankly, put the blame on her and take it off of yourself. I don't see any other interpretation.
Well, I mean, there's still the theory out there that she went missing of her own volition, right? I mean, I understand that that's not kind of the most plausible or the most accepted, but that is something that was out there initially. And I think that her kind of mental state bears on that theory or that possibility. And we don't want to discount any possibility. So if there are people out there that have information about her disappearing willingly, we don't want to discourage those people either. So, you know, I think it's probably has a relevance, but I do agree with you that I think it is a problem, and I think that my colleagues would agree with me as well, that it is a problem endemic with the legal system, that particularly for female victims, that we have victim blaming, of course. It's rampant. I think everyone would agree with it. I think we focus on how she looked, and I think we focus on emotional state. In some cases, it could have a real relevance to the case if we think that she couldn't handle it and went to Canada. But I think in most situations, it is frustrating. I agree with you that that's what we focus on. But I don't know. There's two sides to everything.
Sure.
Yeah.
That is true.
I wish they would just, like, if there was really good evidence that she was drunk, like, please just release it. And if there's not, then please come out and say that, like, we don't really have any reason to think she's drunk at this point, regardless of previous statements. Like, and I know that they don't care about that because, like, they're focused on, like, the case. But, like, it matters, like, to society.
At a macro level.
Yeah.
Right.
No one is immune from the victim blaming.
No, of course. Of course.
Imagine if she was black, or if she was, you know, not a good student. Like, what would be said about her? Look at Brianna. You know, whose case has gotten not nearly as much attention, and who's much easier for everyone to write off as, like, oh, well, she was...
she was hanging out with the wrong crowd.
Yeah.
That's why it hasn't gotten as much attention, right? Because she was a bad girl. So... you know, what do you expect, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And even if that were true, I mean, those are the kind of people that predators go after, yeah. Right? Or people that no one will look for, people that put themselves in those kind of situations. Those are the people that are going to be more likely that you're looking for a killer rather than a suicide or someone that disappeared into Canada. So, yeah.
Definitely.
And predators know that. Predators know that that's who you're targeting, so.
Yeah, they're keenly aware of vulnerability.
I had a couple thoughts on the interview that we didn't kind of address that I just wanted to mention. Sure. And I don't know if it'll be interesting to you or not, but, you know, one of the people, and I've don't know any of their names, but one of the kind of amateur investigators was mentioning how he was discouraged from doing his own investigation or talking to witnesses himself, I think is what, what one of the issues was. And, you know, I kind of want to give a reasoning for that. You know, we've talked about witness memory being, you know, difficult to work with on a lot of different levels. And one of those things is repeating stories. So there's always a danger every time that you talk to a witness that something minor may change. There's certainly a possibility something major may change, but details change over time. And actually, we as prosecutors, when we deal with witnesses, we really try not to ask them the same questions about the same event multiple times. First of all, it can tamper with their memory. So, you know, there's research out there that talks about how kind of the more you ask people about things, the more the details may change, their own recollection, they stop trusting themselves, kind of the more times they get questioned about it. And also, if you have multiple people talking to each other about it, you start confusing your memory with their memory. Things become a little conflated. And certainly if something ever goes to a prosecution stage, every time that witness has made a statement and there's even a word difference, I mean, it can be something really insignificant, that is latched onto for cross-examination. That's why we try to keep it to a minimum and try not to go back to our witnesses multiple times and kind of ask them the same questions or have them talk about the case with other people, because it really, really starts to degrade your memory. So, you know, that could be a possible reason for why they want to discourage kind of private investigation. I think it's kind of a reasonable reason.
Yeah, that was John Smith, right, Aaron, that made that comment. Yeah. And to me, him making that comment, that was like he described himself as a former police officer, and he like took offense that police officers were telling him not to look into something. I don't particularly ascribe much to his thoughts on that.
I don't want my own police officers talking to each other about the case, and I don't want my own police officers to be interviewed multiple times. I mean, just for the same reason.
You know, to that point, though, I don't think he was saying the prosecutor told him not to look. I think he was saying other police told him not to
look. Yes, state police officers, I believe.
Well, that would make sense, I guess.
They're the same training. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
In his defense, I think that they threatened him with arrest if he continued.
Really?
Yeah. They would have charged him with interfering with an investigation. So if we're going to assume that's true, that does seem a little bit extreme. On the other hand, it makes perfect sense to me that the police would want to not involve perhaps especially former law enforcement. Former police officers in an ongoing investigation. So yeah, that makes perfect sense what you're saying.
You're not entirely sure what kind of tactics were being used either. You know, there's a difference between kind of sleuthing, you know, and then maybe some aggressive or, you know, in the Oxygen show, she went and sat on someone's stairs at their private residence. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily inappropriate. I'm just saying that
there's a spectrum. I mean, if you're a reporter, it makes sense. But as an investigator, it's kind of nuts. So right. It's like...
So I'm just
that's the kind
sure.
of stuff that reporters do. It's yeah.
Not sure what kind of tactics were being used, so I'm not sure what kind of, you know, reasoning the threat had, but just want to mention that. The other thing that I noticed was police officers driving different cars on different nights. So that was a big kind of part of who was driving the SUV, right? So well, you know, it was 001, and that's usually the police chief's car, and he usually drives that car, and that's his car, and it could have been anyone else's car ever, because no one else apparently could make the keys work in the ignition, right? So we kind of, like, got into this, like, giant conclusory statement chain. So in my experience, police officers shift cars quite frequently. They shift them all the time, even supervisor cars, especially in small towns. And so there is absolutely nothing that raised any red flags about the fact that someone else was driving the car that night and that the person who usually drove it wasn't there at all. So in case anyone still had any concerns that seemed suspicious or strange, I did not take any issue with it. So,
yeah, I didn't either. I sort of felt like it was another sort of straw man point. I can separate that from the fact that what he says doesn't make logical sense though. But in the people who are suspicious of that, of what you're just saying, I think it's because there was a presumption that in the dispatch logs it says H2, and people assume that that meant the sedan 002, but H2 is a shorthand assigned to a specific officer. So that's actually Officer Smith, and you can see in the accident report he signs his name. And then he writes H2. So that's him. It's not a vehicle.
Yeah, you can't get the vehicle from any logs. They don't talk about what the vehicle is. Yeah, but some people thought that you could.
Right.
Yeah, they thought that's what that meant. So they didn't trust.
That's where a lot of the it was Jeff Williams theories come from, right?
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to mention, and it kind of relates to that point about the car, is that I understand the disadvantage that happens when the records are not disclosed, right? Because this is something where it became a pretty big deal. I mean, it became something that a lot of people were talking about. Who was in the car and was Williams involved? I think that someone even said, you know, if you could talk to the supervisor that should have been in that car, what would you have asked him? And where's her body? You know, I mean, it became this big deal. But when you actually drill down to the facts and someone actually was willing to give you the answers, you know, which is certainly a part of it, it had an innocent explanation, a completely credible explanation, a simple explanation. Someone just drove that car that night. So keep that in mind that there's a lot of information out there that hasn't been disclosed. And I understand that that's frustrating. But I really, really believe that even if it were, I think a lot of this would be explained in a very simple way and in not a way that is a big grand conspiracy or anything like that. It's kind of Occam's razor. I think it's the simplest explanation. And really, conspiracies take a lot of people working together. And these are people in the government. These are police officers, clerks, lawyers. I mean, these are civil servants who are just like you and me, who make barely over minimum wage to serve the public. And the last thing on their mind are trying to conspire with each other to cover something up. And if there was some explanation, I think someone would have spoken about it before now, because like I said, people like to talk. So just do keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement that if the police are hiding anything, or if there's any kind of conspiracy, it can't be more than like the person who did it. You know, it can't be a whole bunch of people involved in this. But the way I'm approaching this is I'm looking at Cecil Smith and I'm saying, could it be that one guy is trying to hide something? It absolutely can be. I don't think you could possibly. And it drove me crazy that in the show, they're like, oh, no, police weren't involved. I'm like, no, they offered you plausible explanations. That's good that they had plausible explanations. That doesn't mean that every single person was telling you the truth.
Particularly when that information is not corroborated.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah, it's like you can't use that as proof that no one on the police, that Cecil Smith, was telling the truth. He might have been, and it's good that he had an explanation. I would just say, as a private citizen who's not involved in law enforcement or state justice system in any way, it's incredibly irksome for the police to take umbrage every time someone suggests that the police might have done something wrong. In a free society, like, I'm sorry, that doesn't fly. We have to be able to raise questions and not be considered to be like, oh, well, that's just crazy conspiracy talk and the police wouldn't do that. No, we know that the police are just people. They're as good and as bad as like normal people. And sometimes they do bad things. So I just from a private citizen to someone who is not, you kind of got to let us ask the questions. Yeah. And not try to like tell us, don't, you know, you shouldn't be suspecting Smith or McKay,
I agree. I don't think that there is a broad conspiracy. I don't. And I do like to have faith in my civil servants and don't assume that they have any malintent, generally speaking. But I will say it's really weird to sort of be, I don't want to say labeled, but sort of as like a tin hat wearing crazy person marching on like the White House lawn with like the end is near poster because you question, like, have reasonable questions about the events precipitating a woman's disappearance, like that the police have answers to.
Right.
So I don't really think that that's that crazy. Also, McKay hasn't really even been brought up at all.
No.
Obviously, the show didn't mention him. So it's kind of like, I mean, to me, Williams was always the straw man. Just because he has nothing to do with it doesn't mean that any given police officer is innocent, because one person operating badly is not a conspiracy. It's just one person.
Oh, sure.
And But it's kind of like going after Smith and Williams, and even to some extent Monahan, it kind of always felt to me like, you know how like you have like the teacher, like that one teacher in school who like screams at the kids who show up about the kids that don't show up? It's like, it's kind of had that feeling where if there was an officer that was perhaps there's reason to be suspicious about, he's not going to show up in those locks. He's not going to show up in anything. He's not going to be giving interviews. They're going to do their best to not not talk about him, not disclose that information. So
yeah, and you have every right. And again, it's kind of their own doing for what may be fine purposes. But, you know, without releasing the information, I agree with you. I don't think that you can take issue with people questioning, because people like a mystery and people do want to hold their police officers and you know, other civil servants, obviously, that taxpayers pay for accountable. And that's 100% okay. And I don't blame anyone for questioning when they don't have all the information. I don't blame them at all. And I think that we should do that. I think that's what makes our society great. I think that's why we have laws like this, you know, Freedom of Information Acts. So I totally get it. I just don't want the conclusion to necessarily be jumped to that there's something, there's some malfeasance going on when it's something a lot more innocuous. It's just that for other reasons, they can't disclose those reports. So.